This is a podcast from the AHRC ICT Methods Network at www.methodsnetwork.ac.uk.
Now, as many of you will know, I cut my teeth in exploring the digital world by working with Professor Kevin Kiernan of the University of Kentucky on his electronic Beowulf. During the time that I was based at the British Library. Beowulf is, of course, the first great English literary masterpiece, and it's known only from the early 11th century manuscript you can see here. At one level, the electronic Beowulf used digital imaging to create a full-colour facsimile of this manuscript, which had hitherto only been available in black and white. A more important aspect of the project, however, was the use of a digital camera to record information about the manuscript, which can be investigated using special lighting techniques, but which cannot be recorded with conventional photography. For example, conservation work on the manuscript during the 19th century concealed hundreds of readings under paper frames. These hidden readings can be read with the aid of a cold fibre optic light, and the readings then recorded using a digital camera. You can see an example here. Similarly, a digital camera makes it easier to record readings under ultraviolet light. Moreover, a hypertextual presentation of the images allows the user to select either images of the manuscript made under ultraviolet light or those under normal lighting conditions, rather than being presented with a single image, as occurs in a conventional facsimile. Fire damage to the Beowulf manuscript means that some of its readings were recorded only in early 19th century transcripts and collations. Within a hyper edition, a hypertextually structured edition, it's possible not only to compare these transcripts with the original manuscript, as you can see here, but also, I can get this to go on, there we go, to compare the collations themselves. So you can compare that level of evidence. In short, electronic Beowulf presents the user with the whole range of evidence for the text and enables the user readily to assess at any point the evidence for a particular reading of the text. Using the electronic Beowulf, the text of Beowulf itself changes before our eyes. It ceases to be the single level fixed object that we might be familiar with from, say, a Penguin Classics volume, and it starts to become more multi-layered. We can begin to see how the text of Beowulf is itself a historical construct, which has survived many vicissitudes and which has been profoundly shaped by the intervention of manuscript curators, conservators and philologists. Whoops. Sorry, I was a bit over-enthusiastic there.
P.
With the P, thank you. Splendid. Beowulf might seem like a special case, but as Kevin Kiernan has demonstrated in his subsequent work on, for example, King Alfred's translation of Boethius, and the collection of Old English Saints' Lives in Cotton Manuscript Otto B10 in the British Library, there are many other manuscripts to which these forensic techniques can be applied. Nor are the manuscripts where forensic imaging can potentially be beneficial restricted to literary texts. Similar methods could be applied to many texts of central importance to historians, such as the manuscript on the left, which is one of the earliest copies of Bede, or on the right, the burnt copy of Magna Carta, considered before it was damaged first by fire and then by heavy-handed conservation in the British Museum, to be one of the most important of the four surviving letters patent by which the terms of King John's grant in 1215 were promulgated. Nevertheless, it's striking that, by and large, and possibly this morning's presentations suggested some exceptions to that, nevertheless it's true that, by and large, historians have taken much less interest than literary scholars in the use of digital images to explore more closely the manuscripts and archives on which they depend and to develop a more sophisticated view of the evidential character of primary sources. While literary scholars have used high-quality digital images to gain new insights into the way in which such key texts as Chaucer's Canterbury Tales or Piers Plowman were created, on the whole, historians have been more concerned to use ICT to enable them to process large quantities of information more quickly. The focus of historians has tended to be on databases, transcriptions, and searchable texts, presumably in the hope that these tools will enable them to locate the essential facts more quickly. Many of the recent developments in historical computing accordingly tend to focus on ways of enhancing the searchability and indeed cross-searchability of such data. An illustration of the way in which historical digital editions place less emphasis on the value of images is the recent CD in the Parliament Rolls of Medieval England, where mainly sample images are provided, despite the fact that subscriber practice in compiling such documents was considered sufficiently important for the details to be noted in the edition. This difference in approach between literary scholars and historians may perhaps partly reflect the greater reliance of historians on administrative documents. The quantity of administrative documents at all periods after the conquest is, of course, quite simply overwhelming. The kind of forensic approach to the text that's appropriate to Beowulf appears completely impracticable when applied to, say, the hundreds of surviving medieval coroner's rolls. Indeed, Roy Honeysett, the doyen of public record editors, has argued that for virtually all post-1200 administrative records, there is no justification in preparing detailed editions, and that for most practicable scholarly purposes, calendars preserving the essential facts are sufficient. Yet Honeysett's own work in exposing the complex processes by which medieval coroners' juries arrived at their verdict and demonstrating how much of the apparently factual information in these records is fictitious suggests that a more rigorous approach to these texts is essential if we are properly to appreciate them. There's a suspicion that historians have still not broken away from the complacent assumptions of their Victorian forebears that administrative records are somehow inherently more trustworthy than other documents, no matter how many warnings have recently been given to us by dodgy dossiers and fabricated police evidence. A more appropriate approach is perhaps that of V.H. Galbraith, who's emphasised that administrative records, no less than the literary sources, are generally compiled from other documents often unknown to us, and they rarely tell the whole truth. In Galbraith's view, administrative documents are as much artificial constructs as literary texts, and as prone to the same inherent deceptions of all forms of textual communication. Issues such as these are not, however, a reason for turning away from the records. Rather, just as literary scholars have developed a more reflexive view of their texts, so historians need to develop a more sophisticated view of administrative records. I wish to argue that in doing so, images of records are a vital tool. To illustrate the point, I'd like to discuss some digital images of a legal record relating to the English Peasants' Revolt of 1381. The assumption that images should play an important part in the digital presentation of administrative records implies a new approach to their editing, and the editing of such historical materials in an electronic environment. So I'll conclude by briefly discussing the relevance of the edition production and presentation technology developed by Kevin Kiernan and Emil Yakov. Following the slaying of Wat Tyler at Smithfield and the collapse of the rebellion which had overwhelmed much of southern England in June 1381, a series of commissions were issued to chastise and punish the insurgents. These are part of a formidable group of legal records relating to the revolt, which record the names of thousands of insurgents and provide details of local disturbances throughout the affected areas. On the face of it, the Peasants' Revolt is one of the best documented events of its kind in the Middle Ages. But the legal proceedings against the rebels were extensively affected by forced litigation, as claimants took advantage of the disturbed conditions and the extrajudicial proceedings against the rebels to settle a variety of old scores. As a result, what appears at first sight to be hard evidence of involvement in the revolt frequently turns to dust on closer examination. Men described as leaders of the revolt submit petitions protesting their innocence and claiming that the allegations against them were brought by their enemies, claims which were accepted by the Crown. In such a context, it's essential to consider how the accusations against particular individuals were pieced together. But there's little direct evidence of this. We have to rely on visual clues in the proceedings against the rebels, clues which digital images allow us more easily to explore. The examples I'll discuss all come from a single file of records deriving from a commission against the rebels in Norfolk and Suffolk issued to William Ufford, Earl of Suffolk, and others in June 1381. After Suffolk's death, a writ was sent on the 13th of May 1382 to his executors to return to Westminster all the records in their possession relating to the commission, and you can see the writ summoning the records here. The reason why it was felt important to ensure that these records were summoned isn't clear. Possibly it was related to process arising from the pardons being granted to the rebels. It may also have reflected concern that the powerful commissions issued after the revolt were getting out of control. Whatever the reason, it's thanks to the issue of this writ that this roll, the most detailed source of information about the rising in Norfolk and Suffolk, survives. And without it, the records would have vanished completely, as was the case with the records of other commissions relating to the revolt in, say, the north of England. The commission to Ufford and the others was not recorded on the patent rolls, but here it's described as a commission to chastise and punish the rebels. And we know from other commissions that those authorised to chastise and punish the rebels had very sweeping powers. They could take proceedings against the rebels both according to the law of England and following their own discretion. This could, and did in places such as Essex, include summary action and military attacks against insurgents. The striking thing is that Ufford and his fellows were not obliged by this commission to keep records, but evidently they did keep very careful ones. On the back of the writ is this return made by a clerk on behalf of Sir Roger de Boys, saying that he was sending all the documents relating to the commission, but that those relating to the liberty of St. Edmund were held by Thomas Morrow. However, the clerk did helpfully send this list of those named in the indictments, which remained with Morrow, so he fills in the gap in this way. The question arises, how he had access to this information. Did he directly check through the documents held by Moreau, or did he already have his own notes of those listed in these documents? Again, whatever the source of information, the clerk seems to have very carefully checked through the list, correcting the names where he'd made a mistake. The clerk preparing this schedule picked out those who were particularly involved in one of the most notorious incidents in the revolt, the killing of John Cavendish, the Chief Justice. Those involved with Cavendish's death were excluded from the general poll, which is presumably why they were picked out in this way. Again, the clerk seems to be summarising from other documents. For example, he notes that Catherine Gammon of Lackingheath had released a boat so that Cavendish could not escape. The clerk first writes that the boat had been released from a castle, but then afterwards corrects it to from the land. Now, this discrepancy may not seem very remarkable, but it raises again the issue of how the clerk making this return obtained his information. If he was summarising other records, were there different indictments which give a different account of this incident, or was he trying to reconcile them? The list of those named in the indictments held by Moreau emphasises Galbraith's point that records are often compilations of other records now lost. Moreover, this list is mysterious because it could not have formed the basis for formal proceedings in a regular court like the King's Bench. For such proceedings, something like this, an indictment from Hartismere Hundred in Suffolk was required. A flavour of this kind of record is given by the first item, which states that the jurors of Hartismere say that James of Bendingfield was chief leader of a company of the commons which robbed Edmund of Lackingheath of his goods and chattels worth 40 shillings at Stoke, which goods were afterwards restored to Edmund. At first sight, it seems as if this is highly circumstantial historical evidence for the revolt in East Anglia. It's apparently made by local men within a month of the rising. But the means by which this indictment were produced were very complex, and its words a long way from any uttered by the presenting jurors. The forms used in an indictment followed strict legal formulae, and it's likely that one has to envisage an extended interrogation of the presenting jurors by the commissioners, which eventually provided sufficient information for a clerk to prepare an indictment. A series of preliminary drafts were probably prepared, starting with rough notes on a wax tablet. Sometimes, physical signs of the process by which the information was assembled appear in the final indictment. For example, the value of the goods stolen was critical. Thefts were only punishable by death if the goods stolen were worth more than 12 pence. In the case of this indictment, the image shows clearly that the values of the goods stolen were only established at a late stage in the interrogation of the jury. And you can see in one case how the value of 40 shillings has been inserted by the clerk in a gap in the document which he'd specially left for that purpose. Nor were the jurors, the 12 good men and true, of popular imagination. Attached to each indictment is a panellum listing potential jurors. On the panel, one of the clerks associated with the commission has carefully selected suitable jurors, marking those who were sworn and striking through those who were apparently not suitable. In this empanelment of a jury from Mutford Hundred in Suffolk, one juror has been sworn and then his name afterwards struck through by the clerk who swore the jurors. Another name has been added late to the list of jurors, but he's nevertheless sworn. While a third was sworn, then removed from the jury, and then sworn again afterwards. In the case of Ufford's commission, it appears that particular care was taken to ensure that the jurors contained the best representatives of local society by making them swear allegiance and even give a recognizance of £40 each for the faithful performance of their duties. These empanelments of two Suffolk juries indicate that this recognizance was levied after the jurors had been sworn. The way in which the clerks attached to the commission were the key figures in determining the wording and final form of the indictments is particularly apparent from the way in which the issue of treason was dealt with. Curiously, it wasn't clear from existing legislation that popular rebellion of this kind was indeed treason, and in the indictments, various textual strategies were used to try and establish the treasonable status of the rebels. This might include the highlighting of certain actions, such as the use of banners, or the use in the indictment of phrases such as in a warlike manner and against the dignity of the crown of the Lord King. Particular clerks can be seen preferring particular phrases. In this very interesting example, uncertainty about the treasonable or otherwise status of the offence seems to have continued right up to the very last moment. And again, you can see how the word treasonably has been inserted by the clerk on the indictment in a gap that he's left for that purpose. Evidence of the way in which the indictments were the result of an iterative process in which judge or clerks interrogated the presenting jury can be found throughout this set of documents. For example, in this case, which describes the murder of a justice of the peace near Ipswich during the revolt, the date in the indictment has been altered by another scribe. When was this done, by whom, and why? The answer is not immediately obvious, but clearly it's necessary to answer those questions in order to appraise the evidential value of this indictment. Moreover, the answer we come up to with this, on this question will affect our view of the entire group of documents. Since the correction is made to a hand by the clerk who's responsible for most of the Suffolk indictments. So if there's a corrector to this particular scribe, that's interesting because he's the main scribe who was working over him. Another example. One of the most widely discussed indictments relating to the revolt in East Anglia is this one, which alleges that Thomas Sampson of Ipswich led the, quote, Great Society of Suffolk. And there's been extensive discussion as to whether this Great Society was a central organising body controlling the insurgents. In all this discussion, there has not been, as far as I'm aware, any mention of the fact that this indictment again contained later amendments by another clerk. And it looks as if this was done because the indictment was felt to be possibly slightly deficient in form. For example, its grammatical structure is rather convoluted, and another clerk has added an extra verb, rose, for emphasis at an appropriate point. This tends to suggest that the clerk responsible for the original indictment, whose hand doesn't appear very much in the commission records, was struggling with the correct form of the indictment, which might help explain why he plumped for the unusual reference to the Great Society in describing the body led by Sampson. A vivid impression of the way in which the information in these indictments was gradually pieced together is evident from this cancelled entry relating to a major attack at Rougham in Norfolk. Details of extra incidents and participants have been gradually added to the entry, but eventually the entry becomes so messy that the clerk crosses it out and copies it out afresh, recasting it in the process. But of course, with their special powers, Ufford and his fellows didn't need to rely wholly on the indictments of presenting jurors. They could proceed on the information given to them by individuals, and the record includes details of a number of trials held by the Commission on this basis. The striking thing is that the record of these trials, whose summary procedure is virtually unparalleled in English history, is nevertheless carefully worded to suggest that the proceedings otherwise followed the format for a normal trial. In this case, one John Potter was arrested at the accusation of John Cavendish's chamberlain for involvement in Cavendish's death. The accusation is carefully worded as if it was an indictment. It's alleged that a jury trial took place, but one wonders if it ever did. The enrolment of these proceedings is made in the hand of the same clerk who endorsed the writ returning the documents to Westminster that we saw at the beginning. The roles of the justices of the peace were commonly, at that time, made up only when asked for. And it's entirely possible, requires further investigation, that this role was only made up when the writ arrived, almost a year after the trials. And if so, the clerk, with hindsight, may well have thought it sensible to ensure that the proceedings were above board and had a vestige of legality about them. It's by no means surprising to find that the information about the revolt in these records was the result of a variety of procedures in which a wide range of sources of information were used. It simply emphasises the warnings by Galbraith that I mentioned earlier. But I think more surprising is that historians using these very records have been so willing to accept this information at face value and have shown relatively little interest in the way in which the information on which they relied was compiled. These issues aren't restricted to the records of the 1381 Rising. They're characteristic of many English medieval administrative documents. To cite another example from the 1380s, Jan Gertzow showed in a brilliant study how the various returns of the regulations of local guilds made in 1389 were a mixture of oral declarations made in Chancery at Westminster, returns written by officials of the guilds themselves, and returns compiled by local writing offices, which often use the very same template for different guilds. In attempting to differentiate these various records in the group of 500-600 guild returns that survived, images are essential for comparing scribal practice across the many different returns. Close examination of records such as these brings home forcefully how we still have very little understanding of how the documents on which so much of our history depends were put together. So, I hope I've shown enough to give some idea of how digital images of the documents are essential to us in helping to investigate their character more closely. However, in doing so, I think we need to create an approach to electronic editing which places the digital image at the heart of the edition and gives less priority to the database or transcribed text. Again, here I think as historians we can learn a great deal from the approaches developed by literary scholars. I've mentioned earlier the edition, production and presentation technology developed by Kevin Kearney and Emil Jakob. This suite of programs develops concepts first worked out in the Beowulf project and seeks a closer relationship between image and edition. It comprises a whole suite of innovative editing tools, but here, in conclusion, I'll just briefly review features which seem to me relevant to the particular issues that I've already discussed. First, the relationship between the clerks who produced the various records we've seen from 1381 is mysterious, and we can only start to understand it if we compare and manipulate images of the large number of membranes which constitute an individual record. In particular, we need to be able to link the transcribed texts, duly tagged to note the various features of the text, directly to images of the text themselves. And this is a concept at the heart of EPPT, in which the editor can map the position of particular portions of text onto the image. In principle, this will assist in ensuring that all instances of the appearance of a particular hand can be drawn together. And with a complex document like a large file of commission records, a tool like that can be very, very useful and can start to help us answer questions like, were different scribes used for particular sessions of the commission or in different parts of the county? Was there an overall supervising scribe? How far did towns provide their own scribes? All these are questions fundamental to our understanding of these documents, and an image edition of this sort can help us with starting to answer some of those questions. Some of the erased readings in the legal records relating to the revolt can only be read under special lighting conditions. EPPT provides tools allowing images of documents under different light sources to be manipulated, enhanced and compared so that we can examine them in various configurations. In comparing different hands, it's clearly unsatisfactory to rely, as we do, on the judgment of a trained or otherwise eye. The duck type tool in EPPT objectively compares and defines the appearance of particular letter forms and thus allows the scribes to be more precisely distinguished and again facilitates the identification of scribal and thus administrative procedures in the investigation of records such as the ones we've been considering. Again, a tool such as this will be critical in investigating the very complex patterns of scribal intervention that we've been looking at. Existing collation tools tend to focus on individual variants. Procedures for identifying the larger movements of blocks of text tend to be fanciful, to say the least. Yet, in examining scribal practice in administrative documents, it is the way in which larger textual units, the common forms, move and develop, which is often significant. We've noted how different clerks in 1381 struggled to find a form of indictment which established that insurgents were guilty of treason. Again, tools developed for literary analysis in EPPT can be useful. This SAMOD tool, for example, allows the collation not just of individual words, but also of blocks of text. The way in which the legal forms were manipulated and enhanced by different clerks in 1381 could be examined with a tool like this. The editing tools within EPPT allow very complex XML hierarchies to be built up for individual documents using intuitive tools, all the time closely linked to an image of the documents themselves. The answer to some of the questions I've posed this afternoon about those documents of 1381 may be very simple, but those answers can only be found if our digital edition incorporates all the relevant information about the structure and character of the manuscript and the procedures of the scribes who created them. It might be argued that these techniques are only relevant to medieval records. I've only talked about medieval records because they're the ones I know best, and this is a particular group I'm especially interested in. But to start to end up with, have a look at this image of the examination of a leader in another uprising nearly 500 years later, the Chartist Rising at Newport in 1839. I think you can see immediately how the successive annotations reflect, just as in 1381, an iterative process of interrogation, with some key components of the examination being altered in pencil. Increasingly, we're beginning to appreciate that administrative records represent artificial textual constructions and are, in a way, literary genres. In examining the way in which these literary productions were put together, the tools developed to investigate literary text, such as Kiernan's EPPT, are potentially invaluable. Whether it's a Chartist trial record, Beowulf, or an indictment from 1381, we cannot separate the text from the medium in which it's preserved. And to secure a full understanding of that text, a high-resolution digital image is indispensable. Thank you.